It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Attitude of prayer. Let us gather up our souls. From personal interactions, let us gather up our souls. From relationships where we have accepted duplicity rather than integrity, let us gather them. From those places where we have promised to be true but have been something less, let us reclaim our integrity. From our roles at work and in business dealings, let us gather up our souls. From those days when we return home grateful that we can have higher standards in our personal lives than we do at work, let us reclaim what must be ours. Rather than playing mute and compliant roles in businesses we know to be cutting ethical corners, let us speak up however we can, to wonder aloud whether we can't all do our work with more integrity so we don't all have to check our souls at the door. And from our nation's actions at home and abroad, let us gather up our souls, rendering to Caesar only what is Caesar's and keeping for our own souls what is most holy and inviolate. When we find high words being used to achieve low ends, let us look into our hearts and find a way to speak out. In all that we are and do, we need to come from a place of integrity and authenticity that is only available to people who have taken care to own their own souls. It is that center from which we need to live and which we seek. So let us gather up our souls from all the places where they have become misplaced or dissipated like strangers to us. Let us gather up our souls. Amen.
Start simply, almost at a cartoon level. The body politic doesn't have elbows or kneecaps. I just wanted to get that out of the way. And while we're at it, Lady Justice doesn't have breasts. Even though our former Attorney General spent several thousand dollars covering them. Cupid is a myth, too. There is no baby who flies around shooting people with magical arrows that make them fall in love, even though falling in love sometimes feels that capricious. You can learn a lot about us and the kind of creatures we are by the way we put together our myths and stories. We make everything seem human, even when it isn't, because it's so much easier for us to relate to something that seems human. Look at our cartoons. We have cartoons with mice, cats, dogs, an occasional goblin, but they all think and talk just like we do. So they really aren't about mice, cats, dogs, or goblins at all. They're projections of parts of ourselves playing out plots taken from our own lives. We project those life situations like movie projectors project images on screens in front of us. And then we study them as though they came from somewhere else. And we can be caught marveling at the wisdom in them, even sending emails to people quoting a line from a cartoon character as especially wise. Isn't this funny? Quoting a mouse or Pogo? It's not that we think all cartoons are wise. Most are just funny or goofy. Only a few seem wise, and we know the difference. When you cut out a cartoon and put it on your wall or your refrigerator, almost everyone who sees it there can figure out why you might have put it there. There's some logic to it. If it's about something that's deep in all of us, we recognize it. And cartoons that aren't useful, we just stop reading. But I think most of our projections are useful. They let us back off and get a different kind of picture on ourselves. It's easier to see ourselves when we can pretend it's actually mice living out these roles. We do the same thing in movies. Look at some of the great movies, even children's movies, like Shrek with yellow-green goblins that we immediately identify as the kinds of things we want to identify with. And we do it in music. If you want to hear what's on the minds of people between about 15 and 40, just listen to the lyrics of popular music. They've been projected out there like images on a screen. I don't know why we do it this way. It's something about us. And I'm reminded of a witty and somewhat famous definition of religion by a sociologist of religion about 30 years ago, who said that religion is the audacious attempt to conceive of the entire universe as being humanly significant. It's audacious, but it's just what we do in our religions. No matter how they do it, all of our religions manage to propose some scheme for reality and to find us a special place in it. That's the story we want. Hindus say we're parts of the infinite and eternal powers of creation, maintenance, and destruction. They made that up, but it's a good story. Buddhists say no, we're not. But we can rise above all these illusions that trick us and trap us and find a kind of perspective and peace that transcends even the gods. That's an amazing story, too. Taoism has its story about the coming and going of everything and the eternal flux where everything is either coming to be or passing away. And they say we can find a kind of center and comfort in living as though we're part of this grand scheme. It's a story. It's a good story. When we make stories for fun, we might call them cartoons and expect people to laugh or giggle. But when we're really serious, when we think the stories we've made are really about the way things are or need to be, then we don't create cartoon characters, we create gods. They're our most serious stories. They're the Trump suit of stories. That's where we project our grandest ideas. Sometimes our worst sides get projected onto our gods too, like the times we have the gods sanction violence or smallness or hatred. We just seem to be walking projectors, casting on the wall both our insights and our shadows. Plato once said that life for most of us is like people sitting inside a cave, watching the shadows flicker on the wall ahead of them, shadows cast by the people and things passing by outside. There's something right about that. But we still confuse ourselves with all these projections because it's hard to remember that all of our great stories, all of our religions, all of our gods came from the imaginations of some of our ancestors. Then the gods get passed down to us without that story about how they really began. But think of Lady Justice, since she's local. You can see her standing up there on top of the Capitol building. She looks like a woman. But we know we really couldn't find a Lady Justice and take her out somewhere for coffee, free trade coffee, of course. And then say, okay, what's this justice stuff about? There's no Lady Justice. She doesn't exist as a projection of our own dreams and hopes about justice. And our certainty that justice at its best is one of the ideals all decent people have. Sometimes we need to gain independence from our projections to gather up the ideas and the ideals they're supposed to represent and to reclaim them. I was rereading a book written 12 years ago this week, Karen Armstrong's classic little book called A History of God. And I had forgotten how candid she is in talking about these things. It's quite surprising language from a former nun. If you don't know who Karen Armstrong is, she's an English woman who was a nun for years and then left the order to become a religion scholar. She has said that she still lives within the discipline, but now her discipline is spending 8 to 12 hours a day in London's libraries doing her research. She's written books on God, the Buddha, and Muhammad, and some others. I want to read you a few paragraphs from this book she wrote in 1993 on a history of God. It might be surprising. She begins by talking about growing away from the church. Eventually, with regret, I left the religious life, and once freed of the burden of failure and inadequacy, I felt my belief in God slip quietly away. He had never really impinged on my life, though I had done my best to enable him to do so. As an epileptic, I had flashes of vision that I knew to be a mere neurological defect. Had the visions and raptures of the saints also been a mere mental quirk? Increasingly, God seemed an aberration, something that the human race had outgrown. Despite my years as a nun, I don't believe that my experience of God is unusual. My ideas about God were formed in childhood, and they didn't keep abreast of my growing knowledge in other disciplines. Since those days, we've put away childish things and have discarded the God of our first years. It would have saved me a great deal of anxiety to hear from eminent monotheists in all three Western religions that instead of waiting for God to descend from on high, I should deliberately create a sense of him for myself. Other rabbis, priests, and Sufis would have taken me to task for assuming that God was, in any sense, a reality out there. They would have told me that, in an important sense, God was a product of the creative imagination, like the poetry and the music that I found so inspiring. A few highly respected monotheists would have told me quietly and firmly that God didn't really exist, and yet that, quote, he, end quote, was the most important reality in the world. It's quite candid. Karen is really telling the whole story here, but it must sound like I'm revealing secrets, telling you the kinds of things that good religion scholars are quite candid about saying in private, that of course God doesn't exist, of course it's an imaginative projection, but that they try very hard never to say in public. Because they also want to say that, quote, he, end quote, is the most important reality in the world. But the reason that he is in quotation marks is because what's so important isn't God, but the high ideals and the dreams and the yearnings that we've projected onto God for safekeeping. And what it means when someone like a Karen Armstrong grows away from God as one of the childish things she has put away, it's quite a phrase, is that she doesn't think the symbol God or the stories our ancestors created about him do justice to our high ideals, and that she can honor those high ideals better without the projected pictures flickering on the screen in front of her. I want to talk to you about God, but the two most important things you need to know about God, about all the gods, are that first, they were invented many centuries ago as vehicles to carry and to guard our highest ideals and dreams and aspirations. That's why scholars say it's the most important reality in the world. But the second thing you need to know is that the reality is not God or any of the gods. The reality is the importance of these high ideals and these deep, fragile yearnings. But they don't have to have the symbol of gods to carry them, as Karen Armstrong found, and as I suspect many of you have found. In the Golden Age of Greece, one of my favorite times of Western history, those centuries that produced their great playwrights, that produced poets and philosophers like Pindar, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, they did what Karen Armstrong has done. They reclaimed their highest ideals from the myths of the Olympian gods. That's really what Plato was about. Neither Socrates, Plato, nor Aristotle cared much about the gods, and Plato tried to write myths that would replace the Olympian myths about the gods. He began as a playwright and then decided he might be more effective in replacing the stories of the gods as a philosopher. Plato and others believed the stories about the Greek gods had become like cartoons. People weren't served by worshiping them anymore, and he needed to reclaim the treasures the gods had been created to guard. The priests controlled the stories about the gods, and they used those stories to empower themselves more than the people. And Plato wanted the people empowered by reclaiming the ideals from the stories of the gods. I think that's the best way to understand what Plato was about. While they weren't very interested in the old Greek gods, though, they were not about to give up these ideals. So they rescued them from the gods, and they made them the sacred center of society during what we call Greece's Golden Age, and I think it's why it's the Golden Age. They called these the paideia, a word you may never have heard before. The word just means, it's a collective noun, it just means the very highest ideals a culture can't articulate. And these, they felt, had to be at the center of everything they did, of their education, of how they shaped children, of how they shaped themselves. You find the root of the word paideia in their word for both child and education, like our words, pediatrics and pedagogy. The biblical prophets in the Old Testament made almost exactly the same move that the Greeks were making in about the same time, about 2,500 years ago. They began attacking the low meanings the priests were loading on to this concept of God. They rejected the distant God who demanded only sacrifice and obedience, and they insisted that the test of authenticity was the religious experience integrated successfully in life. It's an internalization of high ideals. They were gathering up their souls. The prophet Amos said that the people and their priests had misunderstood the nature of their covenant with this God. The priests were saying it made them the special people, the chosen people. And Amos said, no, no. Being associated with this God meant responsibility, not privilege. What Amos was doing was what all the prophets were doing, including Jesus. They were reclaiming the high ideals as things which must be written in our hearts and lived out in our lives, not hidden in a temple to be bowed down to as we listen to bad priests misrepresenting them. I want us to understand what this means. It means that they all saw 2,500 years ago for the prophets and the Greeks and the people who wrote the Upanishads and Hinduism, a couple decades ago for people like Karen Armstrong, they all saw, even if they didn't put it this way, that God is a part of us. God is the vehicle our ancestors imagined on which they projected their highest ideals and most fragile hopes. And the gods are only useful as long as they represent only the highest. When they're kidnapped for low and mean purposes, we need to reclaim our ideals from them, because then they become demonic. Now, you can talk like this all day, but it still must feel audacious, this thought that we have the right or the authority to reclaim our highest ideals from the institutions that not only speak authoritatively about them, but also wear impressive costumes. We project them out onto Lady Justice, onto idealistic visions of America or God, and then it feels like they're out of our hands. Who are we to question Lady Justice or America or God? Yesterday, I read a story of just this sort of thing happening that is worth sharing with you. I'd never heard it before, and I'm guessing most of you didn't know it either. Last night in California, there was a special ceremony with a lot of very old Japanese Americans to pay tribute to some even older white Americans. The story goes back 60 years, and most Americans have never heard it. After the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor at the end of 1941, a kind of racist frenzy seemed to spread through our country, and over 110,000 American citizens who had Japanese ancestry were arrested and imprisoned in detainment camps until the war ended in 1945. A lot of us knew that. The part few of us knew is that several hundred white American teachers volunteered to follow them to the camps to continue teaching. Their little-known stories took center stage last night when the Japanese American National Museum in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles honored more than 200 of the camp teachers. Among them, museum staff tracked down 53. More than half of them were expected to attend the dinner at the Century Plaza Hotel in Los Angeles last night. Glenn Kumakawa, a retired professor who was sent to a detainment camp in Utah at the age of 14 after winning his school's citizenship award, was one of them. Speaking of the teachers, he said, "They gave us the link to the America we knew, the sense that not all Americans were racist, not all of them saw us as a threat, but saw the potential we had as individuals. Inside the camp, when every public indication was that we had no future, you had these teachers saying, 'Yes, you do matter.' They were the best of America," Professor Kumakawa said. "They gave us assurance and hope by believing in us." When it came time to teach about U.S. democracy in the camps, teachers like Margaret Crosby Gunderson told her students at the Tule Lake camp not to give up on the Constitution, that the nation's flawed political leadership was to blame for their unjust internment, but that most Americans still honored the high ideals their leaders were betraying. That's reclaiming your soul. Another former teacher being honored was Mary Schmelzer, who's now 89 years old. She's short and round, with a cap of silver hair framing her face, and her memory remains sharp. As a member of the anti-war Church of the Brethren, she and her now deceased husband, Ralph, opposed the internment. She taught math at the camps. Her husband taught science. The couple's real goal, however, was to help people leave the camps. After 6 months of teaching, they set up a hostel in Chicago and later in New York through their church networks. They figure they helped resettle 1,000 Japanese Americans inland, away from the West Coast military zones. Later in life, Mary Schmelzer went on to distribute relief aid in Vienna, join the Peace Corps in Africa, run a friendship center in Hiroshima, and broker race relations in Illinois. Today, she does volunteer reading with juvenile delinquents at the age of 89. Asked why she reached out to the internees, she replied with a laugh, "It's just part of me. It's part of being a Christian, being a peace person, part of doing what I think is right." What these teachers did, and you can feel it in the stories, was reclaim some of the high ideals they had projected onto America when America was not honoring them. That's what Plato did with the ideals formerly projected onto the Olympian deities. It's also what the biblical prophets did when their own ideals were higher than those their priests were giving to God. And that's what Karen Armstrong did with God. They gathered up their souls and they owned them in a way we can't do without that kind of courage. You can't tell the story of God without telling the story of us. For the truth is that in the beginning, we created the gods in our image, or at least in the image of all that was most powerful and precious to us. And unless we remember that our highest ideals are only on loan to God, as long as those who speak most loudly for Him continue to serve Him, unless we remember that, then we will see, as others have seen, God's corpse turned into a hand puppet by our worst preachers and politicians. A hand puppet to serve their agenda at the expense of our souls and the soul of America. There are plenty of other examples of reclaiming high ideals from words being ill-served. You think of reclaiming the notion of justice on the subject of death row inmates, when most of the death row inmates are of minority races proportionately, and the one thing most of them have in common is that they were poor people who couldn't afford good lawyers. You think of reclaiming words like love and God's will. 15 years ago, I visited a battered women's shelter in Kalamazoo, Michigan. The director was a member of the church I served, and she said, even though she knew me, she was very uneasy letting a minister inside the place because she didn't like them and didn't trust them. And I asked her why, and she said, my experience with ministers is having them come with the battering husband to the door of our shelter, banging on the door and demanding that I return this wife to the man who loves her because it is God's will. You hear those stories and you know we reclaim high ideals from people who abuse them. And maybe the most obvious one going on now is this continuing scandal in the Catholic Church, where many Catholics are trying to reclaim the notions of, oh my goodness, love, justice, God, responsibility, compassion, from a church whose priests have abused young children for decades, in a church that continues to cover for them. These things aren't rare. The history of religion, like the history of politics, is punctuated by those times when people rescued their high ideals from religions, politicians, and nations that were no longer interested in serving them. When we look back, it's those people whose courageous actions we admire. And if you doubt it, remember how you felt when you heard the story of those teachers honored last night. The story of God, like the story of America, or the stories of justice, compassion, or love, are stories about the better angels of our nature. They're stories about whether we recognize those times when the most precious treasures we have, our highest ideals, need to be rescued from those who violate them, so that we can gather up our souls and be more whole as people, partners, parents, and citizens. I said these things to remind myself and hoped you might like to listen in.